Okay, so yesterday we were in the process of breaking up this quadratic action for the field expanded around a FRW background, and we had this decomposition for the fields. So we had we have in terms of taking stock of all the fields, we have this tensor field gamma ij. We have these two vectors, v and w. And we have five scalars. We have phi, we have the zeta, we have b, we have chi, and we have the scalar field fluctuation, squiggly phi. And we were in the process of figuring out how the gauge symmetry acts on all of these various fields. So we learned that gamma is gauge invariant. The gauge transformations on v and w looked like so. And all that remains is to figure out the transformation on the scalars. So we had this gauge invariant combination that we called V tilde, which was V minus A W dot. Okay, so we want to do the same thing for the scalars, ask how all five of these scalars transform under the diffeomorphism symmetries, and then figure out what the gauge invariant combinations are. So what should we expect? We have these five scalars, and we have two scalar gauge symmetries. We have the time part of the gauge parameter, and we have the longitudinal part of the space part of the gauge parameter. So there's two gauge parameters, five scalars. We expect three physical gauge invariant combinations. Okay, so if you go through and you decompose the gauge transformations, just like we did for the vector, which you should do as part of your extensive homework assignment, you get the following expressions. Okay, so I showed you how to do the delta psi yesterday. These guys you have to get by taking, you take just the expression for the gauge transformation of the graviton, and you break it up both sides in the same way as this type of decomposition, and then you equate each side of the various of the decomposition, and you should find these expressions. Okay, so now we have to find these three gauge invariant combinations, which we'll call zeta tilde, big phi tilde, and squiggly phi tilde. And we'll define them as follows. So these are our gauge invariant variables. The tensor field itself is automatically gauge invariant. There's a single vector field, and there are three scalars. And we expect to be able to write the quadratic action solely in terms of these sets of variables. And we expect it to decompose into three parts, into the tensor part, which depends only on this, the vector part, which depends only on this one combination, and the scalar part, which depends on these three combinations. Okay, so now it's just a matter of plugging this decomposition into that quadratic action that we wrote down yesterday and plugging away. And it's, you have to take into account a lot of things. So there's all those covariant derivatives acting on the tensor field. You have to take into account all of those. Those are all covariant derivatives with respect to the FRW background. You have to use the background equation of motion quite a bit, including derivatives of the background equation of motion, to simplify the expressions into what I'm going to write down. So it's algebraically quite intensive. So this is the kind of thing you do. You lock yourself in a darkened room with no windows, and you plug away in pain, and then you emerge and write the expressions on the board as if they were trivial. Okay, so the full quadratic action. There's a tensor part, vector part, scalar part. The tensor part is actually not so bad to derive, because you only have to, you know that the only terms that can contribute from the original action are those in which you have a tensor h mu nu contracted with some other h mu nu. If you have anything like a gradient of h mu nu or a trace of h mu nu, you know it's not going to contribute because of the tracelessness and the transverseness of this gamma ij. So the only terms that can give you a gamma ij are things where the tensor is contracted with itself in this way, with maybe derivatives or whatever in between. So you just look for those terms, and you look for, and you just plug in that gamma by itself, because you know there can be no cross terms between the gamma and anything else. So you can just plug in gamma. And at the end of the day, you find this action is a 1/8 gamma ij squared, 1 over a squared, gamma ij squared. So like this. So again, you see this characteristic 1 over a squared that comes with the spatial derivatives. And these are the only two possible terms you can get by the structure of the gamma thing. Since it's traceless, there's no trace terms. There can be no gradients acting on it because it's divergenceless. So these are the two possible terms. They come in this combination. The vector term looks like this. So it's written in terms of this gauge invariant combination, V tilde. And you'll notice that this has no kinetic term. The kinetic term on the vector all combines into this particular gauge invariant combination. There's no V tilde dot. And that's the statement that in general relativity, there's no dynamical vector field. And adding a scalar field doesn't change that fact. Okay, so the most complicated action is the scalar action. Here it is. And I've organized it. The first line is the terms that contain no scalar fields at all. The second line is the term that's quadratic in the scalar field fluctuation. So this you sort of recognize as an ordinary kinetic term plus a mass term for this scalar field. And the final line is mixing between one scalar field and gravitational stuff. Okay, so these lines correspond more or less directly to the lines that we wrote for the quadratic action of the original theory in its full gauge invariant form. Okay, so everything's written in terms of these tildeed gauge invariant variables, so it's manifestly gauge invariant. And to get this form, there's a lot of sort of integration by parts you have to do to get derivatives in the right place and use of the background equations of motion. Okay, so now, so I should also emphasize that the history of this, so the 1980s or so is when people, guys like Mukhanov, they were the first to sort of calculate these fluctuations from inflation. And there was a lot of confusion over this gauge invariance and how to deal with it. And there are a lot of people who just made a mess of this. And if you look at the early papers, it's just very confusing. So in my opinion, this is sort of the cleanest way to do it, where there's no sort of, you don't fix the gauge at all until you absolutely need to, and you just write everything in terms of these gauge invariant expressions. Okay, so now we need to unpack and understand the actual dynamics of this, figure out which degrees of freedom are physical, and then choose a convenient gauge for doing the calculation of the actual cosmological correlation functions. So let's start with the vectors, because this is the easiest. So the tensors, nothing has to be done. It's already completely gauge invariant. No choices need to be made. For the vectors, what you essentially always do, if you look at the gauge transformation law for the vectors up there, it's clear that no matter what W is, you can always choose epsilon V such that W is equal to 0. So that's the gauge choice that's always made for the vectors. You just choose epsilon so that W equals 0. So once we do that, when we look at the vector action up there, the vector action becomes proportional to just V, grad squared V. And now, V is just an auxiliary field. There's no time derivatives on V. So the V equation of motion, just like we saw in the case of the Maxwell field for the auxiliary part of the vector gauge potential, in this case, the V equation of motion tells us that gradient of V is 0. And then under the assumption that V falls off at infinity, tells us that V itself is equal to 0. So the action, when you plug that back in, reduces to nothing. So there's no dynamical vectors at all in the theory. And you can just ignore the vector part. OK, so all the action is in the scalar part. So it's the scalar part where you find a plethora of different choices for how to fix the gauge. So I'm just going to list some of the most common choices, because you hear these words a lot when cosmologists talk. You hear these gauge choice nomenclature is being thrown around. So one choice that's often made is it's called the Newtonian gauge. And you can essentially find these possible gauge choices for yourself just by looking at these gauge transformation laws. You just have to sort of look and see what parameters can I use to set various fields to zero. And there's various different choices you can make. So the Newtonian gauge is the choice where you choose epsilon s such that chi is equal to zero, and you choose epsilon naught such that b is equal to zero. So the effect of this choice is that if I look at the metric in this particular gauge, it has fluctuation here because phi is still left. The off-diagonal stuff has been completely killed. And then there's a spatial part, which includes zeta. So the only two scalars in the metric in this gauge choice are this time component and this space component proportional to the trace, which is very convenient for doing calculations that are near those of flat space. For example, in the solar system, these are just the two gravitational potentials. Sometimes they're written as phi and psi. And then later we'll see that there's a dynamical equation of motion emerging from the Einstein-Hilbert action, which essentially fixes them to equal each other. In other theories, modified gravity or some other theories with other scalar degrees of freedom, they may not necessarily be equal. Okay, another choice that's often made is called the spatially flat gauge. And here we choose epsilon s again, such that chi equals zero. But we choose epsilon naught such that zeta equals zero. So the metric in this gauge choice looks like follows. We still have this Newtonian time part. We now have an off-diagonal part, which is the gradient of this b. And now the spatial part has nothing, has no scalars. So it's just delta. So that's why it's called the spatially flat gauge, because in this gauge, the spatial slices have been rendered flat. Another choice is the synchronous gauge. And here we choose epsilon naught such that phi equals zero, and we choose epsilon s such that b equals zero. Okay, so in this gauge, the metric looks like minus 1, 0, 0, and everything has been put into the spatial part of the metric. So we have two scalars here in the spatial part. Okay, so this gauge choice is equivalent to the choice of Gaussian normal coordinates. So the metric here has this Gaussian normal form, where it has no off-diagonal parts, and the time part is normalized to minus 1. And all the information is encoded in the spatial slices. I should mention that this gauge and this gauge, they completely fix the gauge. So making this choice, there's no residual gauge symmetry to worry about. But in the synchronous gauge, there is residual gauge symmetry to worry about. That's the same in the Gaussian normal coordinate system. It fixes the coordinates as you sort of move off a hypersurface, but you're still free to change coordinates on that hypersurface itself. So the same thing manifests in synchronous gauge. There's a residual gauge symmetry that that you have to worry about, where the gauge parameters essentially depend only on some spatial functions. So that's this gauge choice is often inconvenient for that reason. You always have to worry about this sort of residual gauge symmetry, but it's also convenient for other reasons, so people sometimes still use it. The gauge we're going to use is also completely fixed as the gauge, so it doesn't have this issue. So the gauge we're going to use is the so-called co-moving gauge, sometimes also called zeta gauge. And to reach this choice, we choose epsilon s, again, such that chi equals 0. And now we choose epsilon naught, such that the scalar field fluctuation is 0. So essentially what we're doing with this choice is to choose the coordinate lines to line up with the lines of constant scalar field. We're using the scalar field fluctuation itself as sort of like the coordinate system. So in this choice, the scalar field doesn't fluctuate at all. And all the fluctuations have been put into the metric. Okay, so to affect this gauge choice in our action, we just have to take this scalar action. So this thing was a function of these five fields. It was a function of zeta, phi, b, chi, and the scalar field squiggly phi. And we just choose the gauge where these are 0. So we just plug, we just set to 0 everywhere we see chi and squiggly phi in the action. And this will give us a new action, which we can call s, we can call it s gauge fixed, which depends only on three fields, zeta, phi, and b. OK, so I won't write out what this is, because it's just that with a bunch of stuff set to 0. But the thing you should notice about this, if you actually do it out, is that the fields phi and b appear with no time derivatives. You may have to integrate by parts to pull time derivatives off of them, but it's possible to do so. So the field can be, the action can be completely written in terms of zeta, zeta dot, and then phi and b with no time derivatives on phi and b. So this means that phi, both phi and b themselves are auxiliary variables and can be eliminated by their own equations of motion. So we take the equations of motion for the equations of motion of this gauge fixed action. We take the equation of motion for phi. We take the equation of motion for b. And we have two equations which we can solve simultaneously for the two unknowns, phi and b. And we get these solutions in terms of just zeta, some function of zeta and zeta dot equals b of zeta and zeta dot. And it's a completely algebraic solution because there's no time derivatives on phi or b. So now we take this solution, and we simply plug it back into the action. And we end up with an action that now depends only on the variable zeta. Yes?
But isn't necessarily enough
Yeah, spatial variables we never worry about because we imagine that the field is falling off at infinity, so we can always just invert them.
So in principle, those are differential equations, just not in time.
That's right, which is all that's crucial as far as counting degrees of freedom goes. Yeah, so in fact, this solution here is going to have stuff like 1 over gradients in it. And then when you plug back in, you can, if you like, think of it in terms of working in Fourier space, where all the gradients just become k, and you're free to sort of algebraically cancel them. OK, so this is, at the end of the day, we have just 1 degree of freedom left, this field zeta. And the action is simple. Okay, so it looks like this. It looks just like the gravity amplitude with the Semplanck squared out front. The only difference is we find a factor of epsilon that appears here, which is just the slow roll parameter, phi dot squared over 2h squared. We haven't assumed the slow roll approximation or even that inflation is happening. This all goes through for any FRW background. But this will be important for the calculation of the fluctuations of the scalar. The scalar action comes suppressed by this extra power of epsilon. So the fluctuations of epsilon are going to be enhanced by a power of 1 over epsilon relative to the fluctuations of the gravity waves. So it's this factor of epsilon that comes out of this whole algebraic mess. That's why it's so much easier to observe the scalar fluctuations rather than these tensor B modes. There's this extra power of slow roll that's enhancing things. Okay, so at the end of the day, we have these two actions. We have the action for the tensor, which I'll rewrite here. And we have the action for the scalar zeta. So we have the right number of degrees of freedom. The original system was gravity coupled to a scalar. Gravity has 2 degrees of freedom. That's how many degrees of freedom are in this tensor action, because we have a transverse traceless 3-dimensional tensor, which has 2 components. And then the scalar field has a degree of freedom, which is encoded in the zeta action, which has 1. So we have this total of 3 degrees of freedom packaged as a scalar and a tensor. So we're going to calculate the power spectrum has 2 components. There's a tensor's power spectrum, which will come from here, and there's the scalar power spectrum, which will come from here. And this leads to the temperature fluctuations in the CMB, and this leads to the B modes of the polarization in the CMB. Okay, so we will now move on to computing this power spectrum. So we go about it just like we did for our free scalar field example. Okay, so let's start with the scalar, the scalars first, since that's the simplest. So again, we define our conformal time in order to eliminate this relative factor of a squared, and then we're going to define our Mukhanov variable to canonically normalize this. So conformal time defined the same way as before, and then Mukhanov variable. Defined now with a factor of z times zeta, where z is just everything that's out front of the zeta in order to get it canonically normalized. So z is defined just to reabsorb all this stuff and make it so there's nothing out in front, so it looks like that of a scalar field on flat space. Okay, so when we do this, the action looks like conformal time d tau. It looks like our favorite flat space massless field. And we have this, again, time-dependent mass-like term. Okay, so now we have to solve the equation for the mode functions. So the Mukhanov equation subject to the initial condition that the vacuum is in the Bunch-Davies vacuum. So at very early times, it reproduces the flat space expression. So we haven't said anything about inflation even still. For any cosmology, you just solve this equation subject to this initial condition. And then the power spectrum of zeta is going to be 1 over z squared because of this normalization factor in going from zeta to the Mukhanov variable times magnitude of the mode function squared. So this is our expression. So for any cosmology, you can solve this numerically if you like, and then you get a power spectrum. In order to get, we're now going to make the assumption that we have inflation. We're now going to say that we have a slow roll inflating universe in order to simplify this even further and derive the expression. So the approximation is that we have slow roll, which means that the universe is approximately de Sitter during the time of interest. And what that means is that we can essentially use the de Sitter mode functions that we found. If everything's approximately de Sitter, then the mode functions that we found for the scalar on de Sitter space, we can just use them here. So in particular, this f of k squared is just the expression that we found in de Sitter space. So here, a squared is the scale factor in the de Sitter coordinates. And we just plug into this, and we plug in for what z is, and the power spectrum becomes 1 over 4 k cubed times h squared over m Planck squared epsilon, where this epsilon comes in because of this z squared from the Mukhanov variable. And what do we use for the de Sitter radius? Well, we should use the time at which the mode freezes out. So this should be evaluated at a time, we'll call it t star, which is defined as the time at which the mode k exits the horizon, like so. Okay, so this is our answer for the slow roll inflationary power spectrum. The crucial facts are that it's scale invariant. We're going to see that it's not quite scale invariant because of this t star dependence. different modes exit the horizon at slightly different times, and that's going to bring in an additional slight dependence on K. But to zeroth order, it's scale dependent, scale invariant. It depends on this ratio Hubble over M Planck squared. So it's suppressed by the scale of inflation relative to the Planck scale. And then it's enhanced by this factor of 1 over epsilon, where epsilon is the slow roll parameter. So I should say that the actual data, so the COBE spaceship was the first to measure this actual power spectrum. And the amplitude goes, the characteristic number is 10 to the minus 10 for the size of this whole expression, except for the KQ part. OK, so now let's study the slight departure from scale invariance. So this definition here of the mode crossing time, T star, different Ks will lead to a slightly different T, which means this will be evaluated at slightly different times. So let's look at this definition for the spectral index that we had. So NS minus 1 was defined as this logarithmic derivative of k cubed times the power spectrum. So in order to take this derivative, it's convenient to implicitly differentiate this equation with respect to k. So we'll take d by dk of this expression. K equals h of t star, a of t star. And this leads to expression 1 equals h dot times dt star dk plus h squared a dt star dk, which tells us that we can solve this now for dt star with respect to k equals 1 over h squared a times 1 plus h dot squared over h squared. Okay, so this is just convenient because it's just convenient for evaluating this derivative with respect to k. So this expression now tells me that k times dt star with respect to k is 1 over h times 1 minus epsilon, where I've used the definition of the slow roll parameter to simplify this. So epsilon here is, in terms of h, it's just h dot over h squared. It's the same epsilon as over there using the background equations of motion. Okay, so now we can evaluate this derivative up here, and we get k d by dk of h squared over 4m Planck squared epsilon, which I can rewrite as 1 over h 1 minus epsilon d by dt star of this quantity. And now this, using our dt d star stuff, I can express solely in terms of the slow roll parameters. Let's see, there's a factor of h shouldn't be there. So this, when the slow roll parameters are small, is approximately minus 4 epsilon plus 2 eta. Okay, so there's our expression for the spectral index in terms of the slow roll parameters. And we see that it's small because the slow roll parameters are small. OK, now we can go and do the exact same thing for the gravity waves. Okay, so now starting with the gravity waves. We do the same kind of thing. We define the conformal time. And then we define the Mukhanov variable. The new Mukhanov variable now does not have a factor of epsilon because the action doesn't have a factor of epsilon out front in order to canonically normalize. So this becomes, we call it Vij. It carries the same two indices as the tensor with this factor of z, where z is just the stuff out in front again. Okay, so the action becomes okay, it looks exactly the same. We now have to solve for the mode functions again. There's a little bit more to do because the tensors have to be expanded in terms of a basis of these transverse traceless spatial tensor fields. So your homework thing defines this basis and the relations you need to work it out. But basically the mode functions that you use are same kind of tau-dependent mode function that we have for the scalars. But there is now a additional label S, which labels the polarization. So this is a spatial transverse traceless tensor. There are two linearly independent such tensors. You can pick any basis you like for them, label that basis by S. S goes from 1 to 2. And then put those basis elements over here as polarization tensors, which depend on K. So this is the sort of mode function that you use to expand the field. And then you write the field in terms of this expansion, which is now a sum over S, K. And there are creation and annihilation operators for each S. Okay, now the definition of the power spectrum is in terms of the gamma is in terms of these gammas, which are the Fourier transforms of gamma with polarization tensors in place. So this and by rotation invariance, this is always going to be written in terms of a delta function, again, of k plus k prime times a normalization factor, mode function squared, and then a delta function between the polarizations. So this is what's defined as the tensor power spectrum. Okay, so now we go through and we do the exact same approximate. So these mode functions satisfy the same Mukhanov equation as the scalars. We go through and we do the exact same approximation as we did up here. And we find that the tensor power spectrum looks exactly the same, except that it has a slightly different factor of 2, and it doesn't have the slow roll parameter. So the slow roll parameter is small, so the tensor power spectrum is smaller than the scalar power spectrum by this factor of 1 over epsilon. And you'll see that the tensor power spectrum, if you can measure it, it tells you directly about the scale of inflation, because it's just the scale of inflation over the Planck scale. So if you see these tensors, you immediately know what H is, essentially. You know how energetic inflation was, because the Planck scales is known already. Once you know that, you can then look at the scalar power spectrum and you can tell what epsilon is. But without both pieces, you only know one. You don't know exactly the scale of inflation because you can't disentangle it from epsilon. Okay, we can now do exactly the same kind of argument we did for the scalars. And we can ask for the tensor spectral index, which is denoted by nt. And by an exactly similar calculation, this comes out to be minus 2 epsilon in the slow roll approximation. So this, if you can measure the spectral index of the tensors, you can see directly the size of the slow roll parameter epsilon. OK, so the quantity that you often hear about is the scalar tensor ratio. I guess it's tensor scalar ratio. And this is defined simply as the ratio of the power spectrum of the tensors to the power spectrum of the scalars, zeta. And from our calculation here, this is simply equal to 8 epsilon. So this is the quantity that was claimed to be measured by the BICEP 2 collaboration, which saw these B modes, and they were getting an R of like 0.2, and now apparently it's all gone away. But you see that there is a consistency relation, that the value of the tensor spectral index is epsilon, and so is this ratio R. So this is a consistency check on the framework of slow roll inflation. You have that the consistency relation you have that the scalar that the tensor scalar ratio is minus 4 times the tensor spectral index. So if you're able to measure both, if you're able to measure the spectral index of the tensors and you're able to measure the scalar tensor ratio, this provides a check on slow roll approximation and the whole framework of slow roll inflation. If this is violated, then you know that single field slow roll is wrong. Okay, I should, so that's it. This is all there is as far as the two-point functions and the information that you get at quadratic order from inflation. There's an infinite number of additional things you can do once you start considering three-point functions and four-point functions and higher, these non-Gaussian entities. So none of these higher-point functions have been observed. Everything is consistent with the theory being quadratic at this point. But if you did see these higher-point functions, there's a whole infinite number of additional consistency relations that are in place. There are various identities that stem from the underlying diffeomorphism invariance of the theory that require various limits of the three-point function and higher-point functions and so on to be related to the lower-point functions. These are also sometimes called consistency conditions or squeezed limit consistency relations. So the framework of inflation is very predictive in that sense. It provides tight relations between all these various quantities. The trouble is that they're basically all unobservable. You can't, there's very little data to actually put sharp tests on this framework. Okay, so this is a good stopping point. So tomorrow we're going to talk a bit about what happens to these fluctuations. So this basically tells you about the fluctuations when they leave the horizon of inflation, and then this provides the initial conditions for when they enter later on. So they enter and then they imprint on the CMB, but they don't go away. They're still there, and they eventually grow and recollapse. They grow and they become nonlinear and they collapse and they form all the galaxies and everything that we see today. So there's another crucial piece of information that allows us to see these fluctuations, which is the large scale structure and the matter power spectrums. You basically go out and you count and you look at all the galaxies and you plot a Fourier transform of the distribution of galaxies, and this gives you what's called the matter power spectrum, which is an additional look at these fluctuations besides just the CMB. So the CMB gives you sort of an early time snapshot of them, but then they later evolve and grow, and this later evolution can be seen in the matter power spectrum. So we're going to look a bit at that, and then I'm going to turn it over to Claire over there, who's going to demonstrate one of these codes that's used to calculate numerically the evolution of these fluctuations and generate the plots of the CMB by solving the full coupled Boltzmann equations for all the junk that's in the universe. And I'm going to let her do it because I've never used these codes, and she has. So we'll see you tomorrow. Any questions? Yes. Yes, so when we have more than one field, we now have more than one scalar degree of freedom. So this is multi-field inflation. It's also a big area of study. So you now have, not only do you have these modes, which we called adiabatic modes, but you have isocurvature modes, which are basically the other field directions. So you have multiple power spectra now for these other field directions. You have multiple, you have multiple spectral indices and so on. But there's only one. So if you think of field space, there's one direction in field space in which inflation is happening, in which the field is actually rolling. That one direction is termed is the adiabatic mode. That's the most important one. That's the one that's going to imprint on the CMB and be conserved outside the horizon. The other modes are sort of the orthogonal directions to the trajectory of the field, and those are these isocurvature modes, which are less important. Say that again about the gravity waves.
The way we're producing gravity waves here,
yeah,
it doesn't require any creating, but it's supposed to be like
Oh, so the gravity waves don't care about the scalar at all. So the gravity waves are just caused by the Einstein-Hilbert part of the action, the gravitational part of the action. So it's really the fact that the background is inflating that's causing the gravity waves. The fact that the background is this exponentially expanding thing, which causes the space-time itself to fluctuate, which is what you see as the gravity waves. So it's the scalar field is responsible for driving the expansion, and then the expansion is what's exciting the gravity waves. But the gravity waves themselves are a property of the gravitational part of the action. So no matter, even if there were totally different scalar fields, if there was some other way you could think of driving inflation, if there was some other weird form of matter that you dreamt up that drove inflation, the gravity wave stuff would look exactly the same. All it cares about is that there is some inflationary background. Yes?
And we haven't assumed anything about the potential of inflation except for slow roll.
That's right. That's right. So in fact, all of this is very insensitive to the potential because you don't actually, when you're slow rolling, you're just sort of more or less stuck at one point in the potential. You're not moving very far. So you're not actually probing very much of the potential, which is another problem as far as testing inflation, because you don't get access to sort of a wide range of potential to really nail down its shape. You only sort of see snippets of it.
Sorry, yeah. I still don't see where you're assuming that it's an inflationary background, because you're just taking a part.
Yeah, the only place we assume that it was an inflationary background is using this approximation here of using the de Sitter mode functions. Also for the gravity waves. I skipped over it, but it's exactly the same. So we assume that there's a de Sitter background because we use those de Sitter mode functions to arrive at this expression. All right, so see you tomorrow.